Yeah, hello everybody. Welcome to the book launch of the Meta Interface, the art of platforms, cities, and platforms. The presentation of the new book by Christian Ulrich Andersen and Søren Polt. My name is Jan Distelmeier. I'm professor for media history and theory in Potsdam, and some of my work is devoted to interfaces, which is why I'm happy to chair this panel, this book launch, and to announce that the book will be published by MIT Press soon, we can say, in May this year. And first of all, I would like to introduce to you the two authors and the two artists, namely Joana Moll and César Escudero Andaluz, who are in their way part of the book and will enlighten today with their perspective and practices some of the issues of the book. So, Christian Ulrich Andersen is an associate professor at the School of Communication and Culture and the Participatory IT Research Center in Aarhus University, and he's Jens Christian School Research Fellow at Aarhus Institute of Advanced Studies. Søren Polt is associate professor of digital aesthetics and digital design at Aarhus University, and he's part of the Participatory IT Research Center and a founding member of DARC, Digital Aesthetics Research Center in Aarhus. Joana Moll is an artist and a researcher, and her main research topics include internet, materiality, surveillance, online tracking, critical interfaces, and language. She has lectured, performed, and exhibited her work in different museums, art centers, festivals, and universities around the world. One of them are the Potsdam universities recently, last semester. And César Escudero Andaluz is an artist and researcher focused on human-computer interaction, interface criticism, digital culture, and its social and political effects. His artworks have been shown in international electronic art events, museums, galleries, and conferences. And since 2011, he's researching at the Kunstuniversität Linz in the Interface Culture Lab. To open this presentation of the Meta Interface, I would like to stress that one of the most difficult tasks today is the challenge to grasp the complex situation of the so-called ubiquitous calm and sensing forms of network computing, hence of the cybernetization of the world and its implied and executed modes of measuring, controlling, regulation, and governance. Christian and Søren have commented on this situation as the current spread of mobile devices, embedded sensors, cloud services, and data capture. So many notions are around and concepts are around these days to describe this situation. Among them, for instance, the stack, media ecology, technosphere, and of course the algorithm, as for instance in algorithmic governance. In this regard, I would like to highlight here the advantages of the term interface, at least from my perspective, because despite the impression that interfaces may seem to disappear, they are in fact key to the ongoing computerization of the living conditions. Interfaces do form the complex of connections and processes that both enables a computer to fulfill its task and its promises of being a multiple purpose machine and establishes the connections called networks, leading to so many questions discussed here as a transmediale about surveillance, programmatic control, and blockchains. Human-computer interfaces are important here, but especially as one aspect of a larger complex dependent on and connected to other interface aspects and processes between hardware, software, bodies, machines, and areas. Maybe four mutual connected forms of interface operations build this complex. First, interface operations between various types of hardware and software inside computers forming their interior telegraphy. Second, interface operations between computers leading to further coaction of hardware and software by protocol-driven networks and, of course, the cloud that is of particular importance in Christian Sensoren's meta interface. Third, interface operations between computers and non-computer forms of interconnected materiality, such as human bodies or technical artifacts, like in these smart cities and their idea of programmatic governance. And fourth, the interface operations that allow humans to use computers more or less consciously, hence operations understood as technical, physical, artistic, and epistemological processes, including questions of theory and ideology. More than that, the origin of the term interface can remind us of the basis of all computer functions, and that is the flow of electricity, and also its costs and its very material conditions. The physicists James and William Thomson introduced the term interface in late 19th century to describe the transmission of energy. And from these two, James and William Thomson, it's only one step to Christian Oleg Andersen and Søren Polt, because they've influenced the recent discourse on interfaces quite a lot. And to name just two of their publications that should be mentioned here, I want to emphasize their book Interface Criticism, Aesthetics Beyond Buttons, published in 2011, and their Manifesto for a Post-Digital Interface Criticism, published in 2014. Their new book, The Meta Interface, The Art of Platform Cities and Clouds, is not only a theoretical contribution rethinking the interface, but also an art book that focuses on the tendency in art that reflects the contemporary interface. And two of the artists discussed in the book are with us here today, and they are part of the following procedure. First, Johanna will take over and introduce us to two of her works. After that, Christian and Søren will present the idea of the meta interface, followed by César presenting one of his related artworks. And after this, we will have time for discussion and questions, and we would really like to encourage you to step forward, use the microphone over there, and to discuss with us what we will present to you right now. And that's why and how I pass the mic to Johanna.
Thanks for the introduction. Does it work? Thanks for the introduction, Jan, and thanks a lot, Christine and Soren, to invite us to be part of the panel. I'm very happy to be here, like really. So as Jan said, all my practice has revolved around surveillance and internet materiality mostly. I've also investigated many other things. But how I got to research materiality, data, internet, it was sort of by chance. I remember it was at the end of 2013, I was at home in my studio, and suddenly I was looking at the computer and said, this can't come for free. This has to have an impact. But the thing is that I was so lost, I just made this question, but then I didn't know how to answer it. So I said, okay, I'm gonna research. And I started to research about the environmental impacts of data and so on, but I couldn't find much. I mean, I found, a little bit of research here, a little bit one paper here, one thingy there, but there wasn't like a massive study around it. So then I decided, after 1 year, it took me 1 year, I did this piece, gathering all these very little papers and investigations, and I talked to some people. Which it's called, well, it's sort of unpronounceable, but it's CO2 GL, yeah? Basically, this piece, what it did is to visualize in real time the amount of CO2 emissions that Google, that the global visits to google.com emits, yeah, per second. So for me, it was like very important to find ways to visualize like this connection between materiality and data. Yeah, and this is one of the experiments I did. It worked quite well, because after you make the connection, then you wonder how you could be so naive for so many years, right? Yeah, of course, this has an environmental impact, but why we don't question this? And this is, I mentioned it in a panel that we had yesterday, because interfaces tend to obfuscate its reality, especially the material impact of what they propose. Yeah, and I feel that it's quite urgent to reveal this. So after doing this piece, I said, okay, great, this is just numbers, this is just CO2. How you could make like the end user more aware of sort of an impact. Then I came with the other piece, which is called, it's also sort of unpronounceable. It's called the forest, yeah? So with this piece, what I try to visualize is an estimation of the amount of trees needed to mitigate the CO2 emissions derived from the global visits to google.com per second, yeah? And I felt that this had like a higher impact, because it's just not numbers, okay, it's PNG images of trees, that they are not even real. But I don't know, it was just an experiment to highlight this connection even more, like in the material world. I still think that there is a lot of work to do, and I'm researching more and more and more. But yeah, I hope we can come up with some strategies that can enhance thought and reflection when it comes to material impact of network communications. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Joanna. So why do we talk about the interface, and what do we mean by this? Jan has already sort of started that discussion. That basically we believe that the interface is a very good perspective on computation, and as Jan also said, we also intend on we look beyond just screen and user interfaces. In our understanding, computers and computation can be seen as systems of interfaces between hardware, software, and humans, as Jan mentioned. Each interface is like an abstraction in the mise-en-abyme architecture of the computer, where interfaces are layered between interfaces. So it's a whole sort of layered structure. And behind each level of the interface hides another level. So in that sense, it's mise-en-abyme. All interfaces are operational dimensions that allow to combine instrument and media, and no interface, such as, for example, the code, the API, or the user interface, are more essential than others. So we also believe that one has to be not an essentialist to understand the computer. Everything sort of moves in between interfaces. And our definition of interfaces is that it's a combination of signs and signals, of the mediated and the functional, or of the semiotic and the material. So in this way, interfaces are neither non-representational nor fully contained by representation. They exactly function by the way they make relations between materiality and sign processes. So they are neither non-human nor defined within classical humanism or humanities, but by how the material environment is rendered computational and semiotic, and simultaneously vice versa, how the semiotic, aesthetic, and cultural becomes computational. So the interface is our take on digital culture and how it constantly combines signs and signals in still new ways, and we believe it's in that sense, it's a way of understanding and reflecting on computation. So then the meta interface, which of course is the title of our book, and for us it's a present model of the interface, where we sort of earlier worked on confined systems between users and computers. Now we have this sort of general and global scale virtualization that Jan also mentioned, and that Joanna's work exemplified. And we believe the meta interface sort of performs three different but related functions. Firstly, it's a concept that describes a contemporary interface paradigm, as I said, and how the interface seems to evade perception and become global, sort of an abstract spatiality everywhere or in the cloud. And at the same time, it becomes generalized in everything, sealed off in anything we may encounter. so yeah, generalized and abstracted at the same time. So in other words, as a concept, the meta interface points to the many hidden interfaces and exchanges of data and signals in a series of platforms that connect, for example, the everyday use of apps on a smartphone to a large-scale global networked infrastructure of the cloud. And secondly, it's also an industry. This industry, meta interface industry, allegedly produces a new reality of smooth access to the streaming of media and smart profiling of consumer needs. However, it also produces their realities. Its protocols hold within them reconfigurations of everyday production. It reorganizes the distribution and consumption of culture. It's, in other words, a new cultural industry. And this cultural industry is territorial, meaning it profoundly affects how we see and use, for instance, urban space. And it also has a perceptual level. It reorganizes the senses, how we perceive the world as a globalized and real-time thing that is yet clouded and sealed off. So we describe this throughout the book in chapters on platforms, cities, and clouds, as the title suggests. And thirdly, the meta interface is a practice. It refers to a particular art practice that questions the material conditions of the meta interface, as I believe Joanna's work is a good example. And it points to alternative ways of construction and design. In other words, as the book's subtitle indicates, there is also an art of the meta interface. And this is also relevant as interface criticism by design, as described in the last chapter of the book. So the following will elaborate how the meta interface functions as an industry and how this also engages the question of design.
So the meta interface is a new culture industry. I'm just going to elaborate a little on the proposals Søren outlined before. Of course, the meta interface is something we know often from streaming of films, of music, and in that sense, it's often something that we associate with the sort of traditional digital forms. Perhaps games is an exception, but besides that, it's also an opportunity for innovative aesthetics. There are numerous examples of this. You could go to e-literature, and there's like Jörg Pieringer, who has produced apps for the App Store, and here you see Jody, who have also made an app for the App Store. So in that sense, it's also a platform for sort of an art practice that before the appearance of sort of the meta interface industry didn't have its platforms, or didn't have its sort of commercial platforms. And these apps, they, as we describe in the book, they often sort of explore the platform as an sort of aesthetics, the location-based systems, the accelerometers and microphones, etc., and produce very interesting outcomes. But there's also something that intrigues us in the book, that there's a certain challenge when art becomes platformed, when software art and electronic literature and other art forms become platformed. They sort of end up in a very sort of technocratic world, that culture becomes sort of dominated by technocratic protocols, by computation. It's a sort of computation of culture that takes over, we argue. Here's the example of Jody, and as you may see, it's in a weird language called Danish, that the app doesn't work because it needs to be updated to the latest version of the Mac OS system. So in this sense, you could argue that the sort of review process that we otherwise associate with sort of critical insights become automated and standardized in this meta interface culture industry. The expert critique becomes sort of abundant and overtaken by automated bureaucratic protocols. So, and another interesting thing that we also discuss is that Apple doesn't have a category or an appreciation for art in its App Store. They follow sort of rules that are not always explicit. The only thing you do know when you produce for these platforms is that apps, they need to serve a clear purpose. You're not allowed to access the library. Every app is an island, as they say. And all apps need to somehow submit themselves to strict moral codexes that exclude, for instance, explicit lyrics and visuals and so on, as there are many examples of. If you could swap to... Yeah, yes, we are on this one. So you could say that there's sort of an instrumental control of cultural production taking place in the sort of bureaucratic world of the meta interface industry. But you could also simultaneously argue that this sort of integration of hardware and software that takes place in these new cultural platforms is also a control of consumption. Not just of production, but also of consumption. We all know this, that whilst we sort of look, engage in culture, our every behavior is monitored and tracked. What we look at, what we read, what our preferences are, becomes kind of a production in this new interface industry, sort of what's also been labeled semantic capitalism. And one of the notions that we refer to in this sense is, to conceptualize this, is Henri Lefebvre's famous notion of controlled consumption. You could say in this sort of extended control of consumption, the relation between production and consumption are somehow inversed. Production becomes presumed, becomes a kind of sort of consumption in itself, while consumption that's otherwise perceived passive becomes active production. This is something that we discuss extensively in the book. The meta interface is also territorial. And here you see an image of an app produced by another group of Spanish artists called La La Lab. And I'm not going into details with it, but it's an audio guide where sort of, rather than sort of directing you through the city, it sort of constantly monitors your location and gives you the language of the internet that's sort of associated with that position you're at. This produces sort of a very sort of particular effect. It sort of reminds us how the meta interface also reaches into space. The urban, you could say, has always been associated with representations. It's always been associated with street signs, ads, etc. This is part of sort of the urban experience as such. You could say, in this sense, say that the meta interface extends and or amplifies the urban experience, the modern urban experience. Google Maps is perhaps a good example of this. That or TripAdvisor or Airbnb, that theoretically with those apps, anything can potentially signify anything. All one needs is just the right interface to understand the signification of the city. In many ways, you could say this opens up the city. It sort of creates some kind of ideal urban experience where I can find the restaurants that I otherwise couldn't see, but it also produces a territory of its own. I think this is what La La Lab also points at. There's a certain kind of opacity in this. We do not know how this interface to the city is brought to us. There's a particular gaze involved in the interface itself. So the urban meta interface has a certain grammar and urban gaze of its own, and this is something that interests us deeply in the book. So rather than just seeing the meta interface as an opening to sort of the urban semiotic space, we argue that you should address how this space is scripted and the kinds of gazes on the city this entails. It The urban meta interface depends on an ability to capture the user's behaviors. The more the city is opened up by the interface to diverse behaviors and significations, the more it needs to monitor the users and their milieu and process these data. The more we read, the more we are being read. But the question is, what are the aesthetic mechanisms of seeing and walking in the city whilst being seen and being guided? In this, we look into, in particular, the works of Manu Lux, who is an Austrian artist who had worked a lot on CCTV, and on the works of Graham Harwood, who has worked on statistic and sort of computational views of the city. And we argue that there's sort of a technological unconscious, an optical unconscious, a computational unconscious. And I do not have time to go into depth with this notion, but by saying that it's an unconscious is also to sort of evoke that the aesthetic experience is double-folded. It's at once sort of directed towards monitoring and control, but at the same time deeply tied to certain desires of becoming part of becoming being seen and being calculated, and in sort of a notion that we adopt from Krakauer, being part of a mass ornament. So this double-sidedness of the experience is interesting.
Yeah, and then we move on to the sort of global level, the cloud. And of course, the cloud displaces its architecture and conceals real material and political conflicts. Of course, again, we saw that with Johannes CU Tugle, and Telekommunistens Octo is another example that we use in our book. It was shown here at the festival 5 years ago. And it's a big centrally controlled Rohrpost system dressed up as with disruptive techno cliches to promote it. So in that sense, it Octo shows how cloud interfaces hide labor, centralized infrastructure, and tracking behind utopian techno business rhetoric. So in this way, the cloud is a phantasmagoria of globalization, disguised as a Dropbox or a Google service. But behind this sort of phantasmagoria, this clouding of the cloud, there are social, political, material, environmental, and territorial conflicts. So when you interface with for example, a Google service or on your smartphone, CO2 shows that what you see is clouded and what you get is displaced and concealed by the phantasmagoria of the cloud. You don't see the effects. Consequently, the graphical user interface is no longer a mere user-friendly functionality that conceals the inner operations of the computer as it was earlier, or at least it was argued to be earlier, but it's also a friendly face to a system of datification that is tied to strategic and economic interests. So through the aesthetics of contemporary meta interfaces, the interaction becomes virtualized, displaced, and clouded. So in the book, we discuss this crisis of perception in relation to also dominant global political crises such as climate change and the war on terror. And we do that with the artworks such as Redberg and Coover's Toxicity and Joha's Endless War. And then a bit more sort of what does art mean? What does it mean in our book? Our main approach to this, and the book uses art and artistic projects as a way of exploring the meta interface. It's our way of discussing and configuring it. It focuses on art that critically explores its own meta interface, and to do this, it uses Walter Benjamin's concepts of tendency, or tendence, as it's called around here. So following Benjamin, the book is less interested in sort of the political attitude of artworks, or artists for that sake, and it's more interested in how artworks explore their tendency. In other words, we are realists. We are interested in how art and technology produce and present a reality. Tendency points to a dialectic material criticism relevant at the point of technical revolutions, like the meta interface. And Benjamin argues that, and I'm quoting, the technical revolutions are the fracture points of artistic development. It is there that the different political tendencies may be said to come to the surface. So to connect with this, the artist should, and I'm quoting Benjamin again, develop from a supplier of the productive apparatus into an engineer. So tendency thus becomes the artwork's reflection on its own relations of production and presentation, its own technique, and this also leads to a design practice.
Yeah, you could say that the book in many ways is an art book. We present many artworks like Joanna's and Cesar's, and sort of reflect on the realism, following on from the notion of Tendenz and Benjamin, the realism of these art practices, and also on how they teach us a particular technique. And this technique is in many ways different from the other techniques that normally dominate human-computer interaction, this field that has evolved for many years through sort of explorations into human cognition and other things, and are now somehow techniques that are being extended into a new meta-interface reality. So what do these alternative techniques that artists such as Cesar and Joanna present to us as designers potentially? This is something that we also reflect on in the book. Is it possible to imagine how design can be built on a realism of the interface as a technique? What will happen if interface design becomes less focused on the, for instance, heuristics of templates and the swiftness of actions, and focused more critically on the affordances of the meta interface and the kinds of realities they produce? But we also say they should become less focused on the tool and more on the apparatus. So what would Spotify, for instance, look like if it was created by musicians? Or how could App Store look if it was developed by software artists? What could it be if it was developed on sort of artistic techniques? I don't think there's time to provide clear answers in this context, but I just sort of outline that some of the things that we look into in the book are, for instance, what we could potentially learn from the tradition of participatory design as it was employed in the 80s, sort of going back to the origins of participatory design, and also revisiting the notion of, or you could say reclaiming the territory of tactical media as important steps in this design process. But this I'll finish for now our presentation of our new manifesto and hand the microphone to Cesar, who's going to present not design, but an artwork.
Thank you. So how our mobile phones or tablet works is through a net of capacity sensor. So when we touch the surface, our electron pass by and the device detect the location. With this idea, in 2014, I developed a scroller toy. Scroller toy is a mechanism that we can find in toys like cars and whatever. In the left part, I add a capacitive capacitive plastic able to interact with surfaces, touch screens. Yeah, thank you. So when you look at it in top, what it's doing is increasing the velocity. You trigger the handle that is in the right part, the plastic touch the surface, and you make a scroll faster. So after that, I improve this idea in the framework of critical interfaces with Interfight. Interfight is a little tiny bot that interacts with capacitive surfaces. They make click scroll, zoom, they work, no? Okay. They behave freely in the operative system, opening and closing application, going to Facebook, making likes, even random comments.
Really? It's working?
Okay. So they detect the light of the device, so when you push them in the top of the surface, they start to work. Let's see how they're working. Critically, they are clicking randomly. They are behaving like human beings. They are going to websites and clicking randomly. So behind this idea, there is a strong connection with data and how to make a pollution, no? How to companies and data brokers get our data through the location where we click and so on. So somehow it's a way of pollute the data to give wrong information to the system. But how to spread it out, how to make it viral, this idea of creating pollution in a didactic way through a, through a workshop. So I also developed this idea in a kit where all the components are inside. And in a didactic workshop, I introduced this idea to tell to the participant what is going on, and the participant get the skill for soldering iron and create these bags. Just some pictures from the workshop, the kit, some of the final outcomes, and all of them today, together. Thank you.
Yeah. So in that sense, what we really think is interesting in Cesar's work is the way that he develops another interface to sit on top of the interface in order to explore the interface. You know. That's a really interesting notion, and Joanna's work sort of also points to this sort of cloud-based global dimension that we explore in the book. So that in that sense, they illustrate the book.
Just to add that one of the things that I also like in Joanna's work, you could say they're sort of one-on-one. So it's sort of directs attention to sort of the hidden, the sort of energy consumption that's otherwise virtualized in the meta interface. But I also think that your work draws attention to the grammars of the interface, that you could argue in some sense that the cloud is more green than the internet used to be, where we all have our own power supplies and our own devices, that it's sort of a more smart way of solving the problem by making by storing things in the cloud and using the energy in one place, where for instance, like in Denmark, they're building data centers powered by windmills, so it all looks green, but it's not, because it also sort of generates more activity. And that's sort of a thing that also intrigues me in your work, is pointing to how it's not just it's not just the material infrastructure that interests me in your work. It's also how you point to that production that also comes with the meta interface. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. This is on. I would like to ask if there's any question or remark from the audience. Feel free to stand up and go to the microphone and let us know what you think or would like to know. There's already somebody? No, wrong direction. He's going for coffee. Okay. Well, I would have a question in the meanwhile. And you end your book somehow with the idea to challenge what you call the ancient understanding of critical theory as something that's just contemplation, and that you propose that interface critique, as you understand it, is is a practice. And I'm just curious to hear more about the relation between theory and practice that you're working on.
Yeah, that's a huge topic in many ways, also within design, but you could say that's this sort of conventional notion that theory sort of develops, actually sort of historically also develops from this sort of tourism. You could say that sort of I visit things, I observe, and then I take notes, and that's theory, right? Yeah. Whereas, and then as opposition to that, you know, you have the real deal, like people who do things. But I think what we also try to enforce in the book is this notion that theory is also a practice. If you look into the academic field, you have the practice of writing, and you have many practices of writing. So theory, by definition, is also a practice. It's also material. And on the other hand, if you turn to design, it would be naive to claim that design is just practice. Of course, it's also conceptual and theoretical. Within any design, there are preconceived understandings of how the user should behave, for instance. Yes. So design is also theoretical. So maybe we shouldn't sort of have this distinction or have this sort of clear distinction. Maybe we should start thinking in new ways of combining theory and practice. And within the field of design, there are, of course, also, this is not new, there are sort of many people who do this. There's, for instance, this field of critical design, but this is not, in fact, what we are alluding to. Critical design is this field that where you sort of create a design that sort of spawns reflection. This is, we have sort of a more activist approach in critical design, where we are more sort of contemplating the idea of producing realities rather than reflecting on realities.
Yeah, and just to follow up on this, it's also important in the book that part of our own research method is also creating stuff. Not that we are artists, but we are involved in various forms of creation. One being this series of workshops and journal issues and publications attached to in collaboration with Transmediale, called a peer-reviewed journal about. And another one that we touch upon is a poetry machine. Which is sort of a long development together with libraries in Denmark and also internationally. So in that sense, knowledge also of theory is also produced by being part of a practice. And we think that's important.
Obviously, your book is a very special sort of theory. And very much like your idea that it is hard to separate. And maybe it's a theoretical position to separate this interdependency. But since Joanna and Cesar are with us, I would really like to ask you also about this relation, which is obviously very important for your work.
This relationship between research and production is completely the way that I'm using for developing these artworks. So I feel that existing a feedback between these two fields and there is the way to push the intentions and to create an interesting piece. So this connection is creating a really important a statement for art and research.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I agree with Cesar. For me, it's sort of a feedback loop, which the more you research, the more you produce, the more you research, and it's like a never-ending loop. And, I guess that's what we do.
Okay. Yes, there's one question, please.
I don't know, yeah, just a quick one, actually. I was trying to think about the relationship between the meta interface that you were talking about and the logistic principle that seems to somehow bring together a lot of the concepts that you were talking about, distribution and production, consumption, and I think the work of Joanna as well seems to point in that direction. I mean, resurfacing the materiality of the interface means as well pointing at how these materialities are brought together to eventually manifest the interface and the meta interface. So I wonder if the logistical frameworks would make sense for you in relation to this idea of the meta interface.
Yeah, in the way we would, you know, if I should give a short answer, look at them as interfaces as well. As I said initially, for us it's also a material aspect that interfaces combine science and materials. So in that sense, they work with distribution and redistribution of both production and consumption, as Christian put it.
Yeah, I think you're right. But of course, there are many other people sort of speculating in this area. And I think in that sense, we're also trying to, not falling into the pit of the not human, non-human, just sort of seeing this as the sort of material world looking at us, but constantly trying to sort of see how the world of representation is always intrinsically linked to material conditions. They're sort of constantly trying to stick to the notion of signs being, how signs and processes of representation are tied to material processes of computation and the machinic, you could say.
Any other questions from the audience? Yes, please.
Yeah, you asked the question at some point, can design be built on the reality of what technology is? And this is really interesting for me because the way it works now is that it's built on some kind of determined experience that the technology can offer, which is both limiting but as well very intuitive, and again, it generates a lot of capital. So when you ask the question, can design be built on the reality of the internet, or can the technology itself define the form or shape that it's going to get? Is this answered in the book at some point, or?
yes, on page. No, this is also a question that we pose, is how can you do this? So we try to answer by pointing to traditions that we think would be valuable to revisit. So I think it's a challenge. I don't think there's an easy answer to this. We try to answer it by pointing to some of our own practices. But we also try to answer it by pointing to existing design practices, one of them being participatory design. And participatory design, to us, is it has a strong resonance in Scandinavia and an interesting history that sort of goes back to the 70s and 80s and the introduction of information technologies at workplaces. So one of the things that they did, it's a longer story, but perhaps I shouldn't sort of open it completely, but to be short, in Scandinavia, there's this idea of a co-determination framework, meaning when a company is of a particular size, workers have a say in, for instance, how technologies are deployed in their, you know, work life. So this allowed in the 80s workers, laborers, to have sort of quite a significant influence on this technical reality of their labor. And to deal with this, they formed a coalition with system designers. And what happened in those years were extremely interesting in how they sort of developed new notions of how technical and social realities could be constructed simultaneously, on how they were interdependent, and how sort of a technical system always embeds a particular way of seeing a labor process that needs to be negotiated, because a labor process isn't always sort of seen in the same way depending on who you are in the system. And so we are interested in how these techniques, so design then becomes much less design of an object and much more design of a process where things can be negotiated. So we are interested in seeing how we can learn from these negotiations, this way of designing. We think there's a lot to learn. I mean, you can take it in many directions, but you could learn by revisiting, we think. And of course, it has a sort of a particular value, because today it's obvious that in sharing economies, we do not, it's very hard to sort of imagine co-determination frameworks of Facebook users or of Uber drivers, for that matter. So where is it that you have these kinds of negotiations? So that would be one direction that I think we are trying to open up, but it's also a field that needs opening up. So we do not sort of provide the clear answers, but we try to open it up. Another field that we point to is tactical media. And this idea, notion of not just art, which was famous a few decades ago already, it is, that this idea that art isn't just part of a world apart, you know, something exposed at galleries, but it's also part of a reality, that it's not just art, it's also functional. So those would be sort of directions that are interesting for us, because it's also our own history. We come from a department at university that's very strong in Scandinavian design, and many of our colleagues are sort of historical figures in that history. But we also, of course, come from Transmediale, who's also an event that sort of formed, at least in my lifetime, around practitioners and not just academics.
And just to shortly add to this, it's also a point, as I said in the book, that some of these development of the meta interfaces are also connected to crisis like surveillance or climate crisis, and actually I think, you know, what we point to is also that the crisis is not something to be solved, but something to be looked upon at the interface, through interfaces, and we've sort of also worked a bit with that in some of our own practices.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say thank
sure.
you.
Okay.
On this thing.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Do we have another one? Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's several.
Please.
Yeah. Thank you.
Go.
So that links directly into this discussion, because I also very much find the discussion around design very interesting, and also curious that design becomes addressed in the last chapter of the book. And I wonder if you would think that we need a more radical rethinking of what we mean by design today, because also, as you highlighted now, design seemingly moves from being about objects and products towards processes, whereas when you think about the histories of design processes, a lot of it is even embedded further down in history after the Second World War, kind of often like embedded in cybernetics, communication and control. And when we think about design processes as processes of engagement, that has more this communication control function that you would require from an interface. And when we then look into works like Johannes, like thinking about design holistically beyond the communicative aspects, so what kind of language do we need when we talk about design, when we think how to mobilize design not only as a tool towards a solution, but as something that really addresses the problem that we would like to address?
Yeah, well, first, design should get rid of the solutionism, to be very brief. And secondly, we believe that design should also have a theoretical dimension that worries about these issues, that design theory shouldn't only be, you know, how can we solve this or that, but also, what are, you know, what does technology create of problems, you know, and what are the, you know, so design needs to have a technology criticism theoretical tradition developed.
If there's anything to learn from the works of Cesar and Joanna, it's that design should be realist. And not sort of this sort of naive realism that's often enforced in interface design, that it should be like being there in reality, but realist in the sense that it should reflect the kinds of realities that the interface produces. So, and any interface would, we discussed that yesterday in a panel, like Uber. Uber has a particular notion of a driver even before the driver is there. So what kinds of notions, what kinds of envisions of a driver does the Uber interface have? We should start thinking of the kinds of realities. By realism is not sort of photorealism or sort of cognitive realism, but the realism in perhaps a more literary and poetic sense, the realism as a reflection on how realities are produced and the realities that technologies produce.
More questions.
Yeah, I was wondering, seeing as Lefebvre features in terms of control consumption, if there's any of Lefebvre's kind of abstract space and lived spatial practices. I'm just literally trying to pick your brain to see if that features in the book, seeing as it's not yet out. Because I'm curious about what you describe as the meta interface. I can kind of see that Matthew Fuller has described through the notion of an abstraction layer, and that producing interfaces seems to entail some level of working with abstraction. So how could maybe abstract practices be reconceived the way Lefebvre thought of lived space as a way of reclaiming space, like the urban space, which is abstracted, but that maybe design practices could be the lived spatial practices in his triple dialectic? Is that part of it?
Not really.
Yeah, sorry to pose one of those questions.
It could have been, but yeah, we didn't really develop. Well, you know, it's. I guess it's. You know, you could sort of discuss this in the stuff we make on the urban. That it is about also, and including also software. You know, how to make software a lived space, I'm weaving a bit. How we develop this, for instance, also through this idea that software development is political and social. It should be a public in a way.
In the urban chapter, I mean, we didn't have time to present, of course, the full book, but of course, it also extends into discussions of open data and sort of data politics in the urban. So that's something we also sort of address in the book, and you know, how that is managed and how you potentially could manage it in different ways.
Cool. I wanted to know your opinion on, more than your opinion, your position on the current hype on cryptocurrencies and in particular Bitcoin, and how we burn real resources to generate virtual value.
Yeah, of course. You know, that's a whole panel in itself, or was yesterday. We don't actually address the blockchain in the book. I mean, we could have, but we don't. But it's, you know, a highly interesting subject. But I do think also it's sort of a paradoxical phenomena as well, you know, that it's both sort of this sort of beheading of the database, both sort of presents opportunities in thinking of collaborative platforms, but at the same time poses, like, if you start thinking of the material infrastructures that Joanna also alluded to, poses like real serious problems. So, and not only material problems, but also the kind of sort of neoliberalist, let's just use the word, ideology that's also part of it. This sort of idea that there's no representation taking place, or no representational democracy taking decisions, that it's sort of all regulated by the system itself. It just, you know, whatever, you know, goes. So I think that, yeah, but it's not something we discuss in specific, but it's something that obviously interests us. To César's work, of course.
Yeah, it's
Maybe you should
want to mention that César has done quite a lot of work in that field.
Well, I'll answer you which kind of value Bitcoin have. The only real value that Bitcoin have is the value that people trusting in a simple number that is nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Thank you.
I am afraid our time is up, and I really want to thank you all for coming, discussing with us, and thank especially for Joanna, César, Søren, and Christian. And I would like to tell you also that there is a handout by MIT Press with more information on the book laying here on the table. Feel free to take one.
30% discount.
With a 30% discount, which is quite an offer. And so get one, and thanks a lot for coming.